This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the Secretary General of South Africa's powerful ruling African National Congress says the party will choose new leadership at its December conference, a move that may end up pushing aside the party's increasingly unpopular leader, President Jacob Zuma, ahead of the end of his presidential term in 2019.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg. Details coming up.
Also, a resolution that would authorize a military force to take on extremist groups in the Sahel is being considered by the UN. And strong storms cause damage in Cape Town, South Africa, and injure at least two people.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the UN Security Council is considering a resolution that would authorize a military force to take on extremist groups in the Sahel. The Associated Press reports France is circulating the resolution after the presidents of Niger, Mali, Chad, Burkina Faso, and Mauritania agreed on the joint force in February. The force could initially be as large as 5,000 military, police, and civilian personnel. The resolution would authorize deployment for 1 year with a mandate to combat terrorism, drug trafficking, and human trafficking. African troops would coordinate with France's Operation Barkhane, which deploys 4,000 troops in the Sahel.
While Boko Haram militants launch periodic suicide bomb attacks in northern Nigeria, the UN says there's a steady number of militants surrendering to Chad authorities. UN humanitarian officials in the Lake Chad region say, as of the end of May, more than 1,200 had surrendered. They say the most recent group gave themselves up on May 27th, consisting of 19 people, including 10 children. Officials say the militants who surrendered need psychological support and health care. However, humanitarian workers have little access to them, and there's little information being shared by the military.
South Africa's economy has fallen into recession for the first time in 8 years. The Associated Press reports the country's gross domestic product fell 0.7% in the first quarter of the year. That follows a decline of 0.3% at the end of last year. South Africa's trade is down by nearly 6%, and manufacturing has fallen by 3.7% in the first quarter of this year. The unemployment rate is nearly 28%, and there have been financial consequences from the scandals surrounding President Jacob Zuma. The country's credit rating has been lowered by Standard & Poor's and Fitch after Zuma sacked Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan. He had a reputation of fighting government corruption. There's another scandal involving the alleged influence of the powerful Gupta family on government personnel and policies.
The Secretary General of South Africa's powerful ruling African National Congress says the party will choose new leadership at its December conference. It's a move that may end up pushing aside the party's increasingly unpopular leader, President Jacob Zuma, ahead of the end of his presidential term in 2019. Secretary General Gwidi Mantishe and other party stalwarts say the party of Nelson Mandela has been damaged by numerous corruption allegations against Zuma. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa's ruling African National Congress has been hurt by a new wave of corruption allegations targeting President Zuma, with the party's secretary general saying Wednesday that the end may be nearing for the increasingly unpopular leader. Party spokesman Zizi Kodwa offered harsh words about the most recent allegations, spelled out in thousands of leaked emails that purport to show that a rich Indian family in South Africa, the Guptas, unduly influenced the president and government. Kodwa says the party does not tolerate corruption and has called for a judicial commission of inquiry into the matter.
We've got a brand to protect as a current leadership, as the next leadership will have the same responsibility. Of course, there are instances, like we have said, that from the past, including these serious allegations, that have been made about allegations of state capture, corruption. The more the allegation of corruption is repeated about a member of the ANC, it damages the ANC. Whether it's a council at whatever level, the more that allegation, and it comes very often. We're dealing with it. The difficulty is that it's not like people who gave them a mandate that go and do corruption. There's no such a policy in the ANC. It's people who are independent in their own area of work. They do things that at the end, they come back to hit the organization.
Zuma, whose term as party leader expires at the end of this year, is at the center of these recent allegations. Party Secretary General Gwede Mantashe hinted that the party's leadership will make a decision then. They could see Zuma sidelined before his presidential term ends in 2019. Zuma originally rose to power in 2008, after the party chose him to replace then-party leader Thabo Mbeki. Mbeki then stepped down as president. Mantashe refused to say what might afterward become of Zuma, who was mired in a court battle after old corruption charges were reinstated against him last year.
All I'm saying is that beyond December, his term ends in 2019. But I'm saying in 20 December, the debate becomes less complex. But I don't want to end up that now.
He also refused to say who the new party leader, and therefore the ANC's next presidential candidate, might be. Possibilities include the current deputy president, Cyril Ramaphosa, and Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, former head of the African Union and ex-wife of President Zuma.
We're going to a conference in December. We'll elect a new leadership of the ANC. Don't ask us who will be the president. We do not know.
Mantashe and other party stalwarts who spoke to journalists Wednesday also did not give a clear timeline for how long the Commission of Inquiry into the allegations could take. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Cape Town has been hit by heavy rains and strong winds as a big storm provides some relief from a prolonged drought. However, officials say the area really needs sustained rainfall over a long period to replenish the city's reservoirs. AP reports at least two people have been injured and some damage has been reported. Cape Town residents have been under water use restrictions and they've been urged to try to capture some of the rainwater for personal use. Meanwhile, at the UN, Secretary General Antonio Guterres warns that by 2050, global demand for fresh water may grow by 40%. He says one quarter of the world's population will live in countries that experience a chronic or recurrent shortage of clean water. Guterres adds that water, peace, and security are inextricably linked. Italian Police Chief Franco Gabrielli has met with his Mediterranean counterparts today in Lampedusa, Sicily, to discuss immigration, terrorism, and organized crime. It was the first meeting of the European Relationship for Mediterranean Security. The gathering was attended by representatives of nine Mediterranean countries to promote wider cooperation. After the meeting, the police chief held a press conference. Reporter Josephine McKenna has details and also updates us on a new development. Italian Coast Guard officers are to be equipped with arms for use during migrant rescue operations. She spoke with me first on the police chief's press conference.
Well, this was an important meeting between the head of the Italian police, Franco Gabrielli, and his counterparts from other countries around the Mediterranean, including France, Greece, and Malta. And this was really to look at several aspects of what is going on in the Mediterranean, illegal immigration, the tidal wave of new arrivals that we're seeing, as well as security and terrorism. And at the end of this meeting, Gabrielli said that the police were more concerned about the degree of human trafficking than they were, in fact, about illegal immigration. But he said that there were three major priorities: fighting human trafficking, secondly, identifying everyone who arrives in Europe who could be a risk. And the third thing was fighting those who intend on exploiting those who are coming to Europe in search of a better life. So some interesting talks there today. Obviously, some major issues to be discussed, particularly after the terrorist attacks that we've seen in the UK recently.
So it seems that they're all on the same page, these Mediterranean police chiefs, in terms of fighting human trafficking, terrorism, and really looking at illegal immigration.
Yes, of course, it's always easy to talk about that at a meeting, but it's also about sharing the burden. I think Italy is looking to these other countries to do more with the rescues and also to take more migrants. We've had more than 70,000 arrivals in Europe this year, 60,000 in Italy. And there was also debate about Youssef Zaghaba, the Moroccan-Italian terrorist that was involved in those attacks in London at the weekend. The Italian police chief was also quizzed about whether the Italians had done enough to notify the British police about his movements and the fact that the Italian police had been watching him. Some toing and froing there between the British and the Italian police about sharing information. So that's going to be something that is a priority in the future as well for these police and intelligence services to share more information about immigrants and about potential terrorists who are on a path to radicalization.
Were there any action plans that were put into effect at the meeting?
After the press conference, I must say that Gabrielli was very general about his comments, and he was quizzed extensively about whether the Italian police should have done more to stop Youssef Zaghaba. But he said it's always easier to speak about something once it's happened. Subjects may be identified, but it's impossible to always issue some kind of generic alert when databases are so full these days. Some very general comments. I imagine they have come up with more detailed proposals among themselves, seeking greater cooperation on that international level.
In another development regarding the Italian Coast Guard, I understand there were some new developments regarding migrant rescues. Can you tell us about that?
There's been a great deal of controversy recently about the Libyan Coast Guard being armed and allegations that they fired on Italian Coast Guard officials recently. And that's quite strange given that the Italians were the ones that have been training the Libyan Coast Guard to strengthen their coastal security. So Italian Coast Guard officials will be equipped with arms that they will be able to use during the course of migrant rescue operations. That's quite a significant move. It's also quite significant because it's high risk and we could see some casualties if things go terribly wrong. But certainly the Coast Guard wants to have greater protection on board because it's such a volatile situation in the Mediterranean.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome.
Eighteen past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Recently, the internationally recognized government of Libya, the Government of National Accord, divided the country into seven military zones. The move was made by Faiz al-Sarj, the head of the Presidential Council of the government. But a spokesman for the Libyan National Army, an opposition military faction based in eastern Libya, rejected the move. Colonel Ahmed al-Mesmari, the spokesman of the Libyan National Army, said LNA forces are advancing towards the west and reconciliation efforts are seemingly going nowhere. Rhiannon Smith is the managing editor of Libya Analysis website. Reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi asked what the disagreement means for Libya.
Well, the first thing to recognise here is that the issue of who controls the military in Libya is one of the key sticking points between the eastern faction, the House of Representatives, and the west, so Sarraj and the Government of National Accord. Therefore, any kind of decisions that affect how that sort of military control is managed are likely to be controversial. However, the fact that Mesmari is rejecting this decision is not surprising, because they want Haftar to be in control, and some of the different regions, they've actually appointed Misratan commanders who are opposed to Haftar. However, although on the face of it, this seems like it could be a reason for conflict to escalate. It may actually be that this is a precursor to greater political reconciliation if, in fact, the reason that Sarraj has come up with these sort of new military zones is actually to lay the foundations to involve some of the eastern commanders, including Haftar, in a new kind of military structure for the country.
But al-Mismari argued that the decree on establishing the zones was principally a political decision because the boundaries set for the Misrata military zone included all petroleum fields and major export terminals, and he said Haftar's forces are advancing toward the west. Is Libya witnessing a military solution?
So yes, that is correct. And this is why the military decision to have these military zones has caused a lot of outrage, particularly in eastern Libya, because they have essentially said that this central region, as they've called it, one of the seven regions, covers the oil crescent region, which has the majority of Libya's oil ports and oil fields. And therefore, whoever controls that region really controls a lot of the wealth and therefore power in Libya. And it's this region where there's been a lot of ongoing conflict between the different parties recently. Therefore, it is likely that this has a political angle to it. However, of course, just by Sarraj saying this is the new zone and this is who the commander is going to be does not give them actual control on the ground. And what we've actually seen in the last couple of weeks is the GNA-aligned Misratan forces in that sort of oil crescent area around Sirte and just to the east and south of there have withdrawn from a lot of those areas. And the Libyan National Army have actually gained a lot of ground, and they've recently taken the very important strategic Jufra air base, giving them more access to kind of southwestern area of Libya. So it may be that this decision to kind of issue this decision by Sarraj is political, and it's actually designed to kind of try and at least symbolically counter this perceived advances that are being made by the LNA in that area. However, what happens next is not clear yet. It may be, as I mentioned, that this could lay the ground towards some sort of reconciliation if there are, in fact, deals going on in the background. However, the situation remains volatile, and as we know, the political leaders in Libya don't have a great deal of control over the militias on the ground. Therefore, this may be the spark for greater conflict, which could move ever further westwards if the LNA kind of push forwards from Jufra.
But it seems that the negotiations between al-Sarraj and Haftar are going nowhere. Would that mean that eventually Haftar will try to use force to impose his will on the other parties and factions in Libya?
Well, we know with Haftar that he has, in fact, most of the time he's ruled out political action and has advocated for a military solution. So that's certainly a possibility. And I think the end game for Haftar, that may well be the case. If the best way for him to exert power over Libya is militarily, I don't think he will have any qualms about doing that. However, because in the last 2 weeks we've seen the pro-GNA militias in Tripoli making significant gains against the sort of more hardliner anti-GNA and anti-Haftar militias, it may now be that Sarraj is more able to re-enter publicly into these kind of reconciliation talks.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the website Libya Analysis. She was talking to reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi.
A new report by the UN Food and Agriculture Organization encourages governments to register and license cross-border traders in the informal sector. Economists say this type of trade accounts for almost half of gross domestic product in Africa and employs most Africans. The FAO representative in Rwanda, Atahir Maiga, tells VOA's William Eagle that governments gain by having a new source of taxes.
It contributes to a big chunk of the national economy in most African countries. I think across the continent, we're talking about around 42% on GDP in terms of contribution. But also, this is something that is almost invisible to government tax systems and so on. And also, it creates a lot of employment, up to 70% across Africa. And also, women play a very important role in it. We know that up to 40% or even 60% of these concern women. So what comes really, in the way of these traders, mostly it has to do with the regulatory framework, which speaks to the taxing system, the licensing, which are sometimes very cumbersome. And then because because this cross-border traders, most of the time, are very small holders with very limited capacity and even access to capital. So those are disincentive, you know, to them in most of the case.
Do you find that small cross-border traders are actually trying to avoid the government? And if that's the case, how do you convince them that there are benefits to becoming part of the formal economy, paying taxes, and being licensed?
In fact, your question can be also looked at from the other side. And I don't know if we can say they are strictly avoiding, or even is the government paying adequate attention to them in the policy environment and so on that can address their issue. So in terms of benefit that can be related to formalization of the informal cross-border trade, I think benefits are on both sides. For instance, on government side, informal cross-border trade, since it is not appearing in any way in the government taxing or revenue capturing system, it means it's a lost revenue. So I think having them in the formal system will be a benefit to government, at least on the revenue collection side. Now, on the cross-border trader themselves, there are a number of constraints, but if those constraints are addressed, this can be a way for them also to have more sustainable activities and more reliable ones. If they come into the formal system, they can have a better access to financing mechanism that exists. They can have some trade and market information that can increase the business that they are doing. So those are things that can only happen if they are more into the formal system. So it is important also for them to benefit from capacity support that will improve even the efficiency of the businesses that they are doing. So, for instance, if market infrastructure like storage system, refrigeration, those are all incentive for them to even better the business that they are engaged in.
Rwanda has become a model for working with informal traders. How many traders has Rwanda brought into the system? And what measures did the government and perhaps NGOs take to involve and educate the traders, including women?
In terms of the cross-border trade, the measures that are being taken is really to see how to support the informal cross-border traders in their capacity to make sure that they get access to the right information, market information, and also some of the measures also are related to improving the regulatory framework, which means having one-stop order center whereby licensing and inspection, all of this can be happening at one spot. So this is one important measure that is happening. And in Rwanda also, the corruption, the fight against the corruption, in fact, is a national priority. So that is also something that is very important in Rwanda, that the authorities are very serious about tracking corrupt practices. So traders are less vulnerable to those kind of practices from the Rwanda side compared to what we see in many other places. And also the implementation of all the measures that are in this cross-border strategy, because Rwanda is so very serious and implementing, because in many places we see policies and strategies for those kind of issues that their implementation is lacking. So there is a very, very strong commitment in implementing the measures that are in the strategy and the policies that are around these matters.
That was Adahir Maiga, the FAO representative for Rwanda. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali, coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rashad Smith, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa. Next week on Straight Talk Africa, we look at reflections of what most voices on the continent say is the Africa that we need, meaning good governance, rule of law, and social and economic justice for all. That's next week right here on Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.